We hope you enjoy this message from St. Martin C3, a location of C3 Church, Christchurch.
We are going to continue our series this morning called Love Your Neighbour. If you've got a Bible, please turn in it to Luke chapter 10. We're going to read a very famous passage of Scripture and go a little bit deeper into it this morning. But to begin with, what if I told you that there was a pandemic going on in our world right now that was more widespread than COVID-19? What if I told you that, in fact, in America, it affects more than 10 times the numbers of COVID-19? We've developed technology to combat it, but instead it has made the problem much worse. This pandemic is not spread in crowds, but actually gets worse in isolation. The pandemic I'm talking about is loneliness. Loneliness. Check out this quote from David Kinnaman, the head of the Barna Research Group. He says, "Today, an epidemic of loneliness sequesters tens of millions of people. Barna's data shows that adults are twice as likely to say they are lonely compared to a decade ago." Twice as likely compared to a decade ago. About one out of every five Americans say they feel lonely. Regardless of the hundreds of millions of smartphones we've bought, apps we've loaded, posts we've written and read, and the likes and retweets we've given and received, we feel lonelier than ever. There are many lonely people all around us. The good news, however, is that our followers of Jesus have the cure: love. The gospel of Jesus Christ is all about love. Love is mentioned more than 700 times in the Bible. And when we follow Jesus, we're fully loved and drawn into a community of God followers who help us feel connected. Barna's research shows that those who are resilient disciples, those who are faithful followers of Jesus, are less likely to feel lonely, significantly less likely to feel lonely. And that's why we're doing this series called Love Your Neighbor. In it, we are looking at how we can bring the love of God to the people that we meet. In this series, we're asking, what does it look like for us to love as St. Martin C3 Church to our community, but also to those who are closest in each of our lives? And last week, as we've talked about, we began with prayer. Because as we pray God's blessing upon others, He changes hearts. He changes their heart to be open to His love. He changes our heart to give us the ability to love. The rest of what we say in this series is meaningless if we don't understand how important prayer is to see God move through us. Now today, what we're going to talk about is intentionally building relationships with others that we might share God's love with them. So we're going to read Luke chapter 10, and we're going to read from verse 25. It says this: "One day an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question, 'Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life?' Jesus replied, Does the law of Moses say? What is written in the law?' He replied. 'How do you read it?'" I'll just read what's on the screen because I'm reading a different version, which is always confusing, right? I'll read what's on the screen. "He answered, 'Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself.' 'You have answered correctly,' Jesus replied. 'Do this and you will live.' But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' Now Jesus is going to respond to this with a story. We know this story, very famous story, is the parable of the Good Samaritan. I'm hoping we can read it today with fresh eyes as we're talking about building intentional relationships. But one thing I want us to see straight off is as we read this story, that this Jesus, well, we call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's a really positive way of titling the story. In fact, if you look at the content of this story, you'll see that the focus is not just on the Samaritan and his response, but the lack of response from the righteous God followers. In our context, if you were so inclined, you could call this story the parable of the bad Christian. Let's read it. In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road from Jerusalem to Jericho, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, a temple assistant, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. When he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him into an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? Jesus asks. The expert in the law replied, can't even say Samaritan. He says, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus then told him, go and do likewise. So let's track the characters in this particular play and let's see the things that they do. First, we have our robbers. They steal and they injure. See, the road between Jerusalem and Jericho was known as a nasty piece of road with lots of twists and turns that robbers would use. Robbers at that time were actually known to be pretty decent. They wouldn't attack you unless you tried to defend yourself. And that's obviously what happened to this poor character, and he gets beaten to a pulp. Then the priest comes, and it says the priest is going from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And priests in the first century were wealthy people. They would often live in Jericho and commute to Jerusalem, work for 2 weeks in Jerusalem, and then come home. And that was probably what this priest was doing. As people of means, he wouldn't have walked this journey. Instead, he would ride it. He had the means to transport this man to safety, but he didn't do it. And some people say, well, maybe he didn't want to be ritually unclean. He'd finished his time at the temple. He was going home. He had no excuse. The temple assistant also sees and does nothing, the Levite. Jesus tells us in another version, it kind of translates it to say that he takes the time to walk across the road and observe the difficulty of the man. His action is a step up from the priest. He actually goes and sees, but he still chooses to do nothing. I mean, he doesn't even do doctor's ABC. He doesn't even go through the, maybe they didn't know doctor's ABC, then they should have, right, Karen? Yeah, we should all know doctor's ABC. But he doesn't do anything to help this man. Then we've got the Samaritan who sees, feels compassion, and acts. For a Jew, a Samaritan would usually be the punchline of a joke, not the hero of the story. It would be like a white supremacist coming across an African American and then doing something to help him. However, the Samaritan didn't see an adversary. He just saw a man in need of love. And so he acts. Now, over the coming weeks, we're going to talk about the things we can do with the relationships that we have. We're going to look at how we can love the people in our world through word, through sign, and through deed. Today, what we don't want to do is we want to look at the lessons from the story of how we can get closer to others in relationship. So I've got 4 things I want to draw out of this story. The first one is that we must view others with compassion, not as a duty. View others with compassion, not as a duty. Now listen, duty does have some power to compel behavior. And there are times when we need to do things we don't feel like doing. But the problem with duty is that it's not a very powerful motivator, not long term. Duty was not powerful enough for the priest and the temple assistant to do something. They actually had a duty to care for this man. It was in the law. They had a responsibility. But duty wasn't powerful enough. Now, I've worked in my life with some fantastic relational people. I remember talking to one who was feeling a little bit burnt out. They felt an obligation to care for everyone, and they became overwhelmed. And paradoxically, they stopped caring about the people in their life, the people who they were doing ministry to. And I wonder if that's what happened to the priest and the temple assistant. They'd done their 2 weeks where people were coming in and they were having to offer sacrifices for them. They were having to talk through their sin offerings and their guilt offerings and all the other offerings that they had to do. And after 2 weeks of all of this, duty, 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 walking down the road, that one extra person was just too much for them to care for. But the Samaritan was moved by compassion. Compassion is so powerful that it empowers the Samaritan who was despised to begin to undo the wrong that has been done to the man. The Samaritan treats the wounds, overcoming the Levite's failure in helping. The Samaritan transports the man, overcoming the priest's failure in caring. The Samaritan spends money on him, compensating for the thieves who stole from him. Compassion is a far more powerful motivator than our religious obligation. If we think we have to get close to others, then we will often miss opportunities. However, if genuine love and compassion moves us, then we can't help but see and act and love our neighbor. The second thing that we find in the story is that getting close to others will cost us. Loving others is not just about loving the people in our life who is easy to love, but we must love those it's hard to love. I've got to be honest with you, I sometimes find people hard to love. They can be grumpy and closed off to the gospel, or they can put up a mask that makes them seem self-sufficient. They try to make it appear that they don't need any help, that they've got it all together. You know, even as I was writing this section of this message, I had a former church member come into our offices. And he's someone who now says that he doesn't want to come to church anymore and he rejects God. But he still turns up about every 2 weeks and has some quite flimsy excuses to why he's turned up at all. But the truth is that God's still doing something in his life. And he's lonely. He is part of that lonely epidemic. And it's difficult because I try to help him. I try to move him forward. But he just seems to have a brick wall up. And my responsibility there is just to keep on loving him. Just to keep on loving and letting God make the breakthrough that God will make in his life. One group that we have in our church where we have this ability to show compassion, to get to know others, to love them, and yeah, there's a little bit of a cost involved as well, is a group we run called Toddle Rock. And so I'm going to invite the most beautiful woman in the room, my wife, to come up and tell us about the amazing work that Toddle Rock does in our church and through our church into our community. Thank you, Joanna.
Good morning, church. My name is Joanna. Thank you for the lovely introduction, darling. Let me tell you about Toddle Rock. Toddle Rock is a music and play session for 0 to 5-year-olds and their big people. And we've been running it here in St. Martin's for about 3 years, every Wednesday morning during the school term from 9:30 till 11. We normally get between 60 and 90 people, although a couple of weeks ago we smashed that and had well over 100 people smooshed into the foyer area out there. It was craziness. We normally get mums and their kids. We get the occasional dad. Sometimes we get grannies, aunties, uncles, nannies, caregivers. We welcome them all. If they've got a little person and they're looking after them, they are welcome at Toddle Rock. And what we do is we spend half an hour singing and dancing. As you can see, that's, yep, pretty typical of what we do. And then we have morning tea together. We provide food for the kiddies and we provide food for the grown-ups. And then we get the toys out and it's merry chaos. So that's what Toddle Rock is. But why do we as a church run this ministry for our community? Well, there is so much more to Toddle Rock than music and food and toys. Toddle Rock is a place of community and Toddle Rock is a place of connection. Because looking after little people is hard. It's exhausting and it's really isolating, especially if you're new to town or you don't have much family support. And so what we want to do as a church is provide a place where people are welcome, where they're accepted, where they're loved, and where they can connect. We do sing a song about God every week. We say grace every week. We occasionally pray as a group or pray for people individually. And we invite them to church for special services and special events. And we do preach Jesus at Easter and we preach Jesus at Christmas. But largely, Total Rock is an opportunity for us to preach Jesus through our actions. Here's what excites me about Total Rock, and there's a lot. We're serving our community. We're connecting with our community. We're meeting a need in our community. We're loving our community, and we're interacting with our community. During lockdown, I was able to stay connected with five or six of our Total Rock families just by going for a walk around the block and waving at them through the windows or standing at the edge of the driveway and yelling up the driveway, socially distanced, and asking how they were doing, making sure they were doing okay and encouraging them. There's something really valuable about serving in the community that we live in. God is able to create opportunities for us to share his love with those that we live alongside. And I think that's exciting. But it's hard work. Here's what we do on a Wednesday. We turn up at 8:30 and we completely rearrange the foyer. We get all the toys out from this end of the foyer and we move them to the middle of the foyer. We prepare morning tea. We set up a TV, sound system, microphone. We greet people as they arrive. We chat to them and their children before the program starts. We dance and we sing. We provide morning tea for the kids and the grown-ups. We chat to the grown-ups while they're eating and make sure they've got coffee and cake. We clean up after morning tea, after the grown-ups and after the kids. We get the toys out from the middle of the foyer and spread them everywhere. We talk to the adults while their kids are playing. We do the dishes. We put all the toys away from there down to that end of the foyer again. We vacuum and we put the foyer back together. And that's just what we do on a Wednesday. There's all the other things behind the scene that go on during the week. We have a small team of people who make this happen every week, and some of them come just to get the toys out and move them from one end of the foyer to the other. Some come just to help in the kitchen. We used to have a lady who just turned up to vacuum after the session. You don't have to be a kids person to serve in a ministry like Total Rock. You just have to have time. A spare half an hour, a spare hour on a Wednesday morning, it all helps. So if you've got some time to offer and have a heart to get alongside families in our community or just want to know more about Total Rock, come and have a chat to me after the service. I would love to talk about Total Rock because I'm so proud of what we do on a Wednesday morning. And I know that it does make a difference in the families of those in our community.
Yeah, give her a hand. They do an amazing job at Total Rock. Lots of stuff going on here, ways to connect with the community. There are people who come in who have very little other support networks, and it is a fantastic ministry. But it does cost something. Think about the Good Samaritan and what even doing what he did cost him. It cost him cloth, which probably came from his own clothes. It cost him wine. It cost him oil. It cost him transport, money, and a sacrifice of time. The Samaritan actually put himself at considerable risk to rescue this man. Not just from the robbers who could still be lurking, but actually from the likely Jewish inn. Imagine if one of your enemies rides into town and on the back of his donkey or whatever it is one of your friends and they're injured. What would you assume? You would assume that your enemy had done it. And in that time, at that place, he was in real danger by helping this man. This act of kindness was a significant risk and a cost of the Samaritan. At a deeper level, it's actually a picture of what Jesus has done for us. Jesus is just like the Samaritan in this story. There will be a risk and there'll be cost for us too. Sometimes it's a cost of time to help out at a program like Total Rock. Sometimes it's a cost of energy to try and engage others. But if compassion moves you, that's what love does. Right, so number three from the story is that we need to create margin for loving relationships. As the Samaritan did, that cost of time, the priest didn't have any energy for it, nor did the temple assistant, but the Samaritan do. Can I ask you, do you have space in your life for others? Sometimes our digital connections and full schedules have become so consuming that we're settling for friendships which are not as close, both in emotional depth and in time spent with someone. If we do a stock take of our lives, we might find that we only have enough room for our family and our workplace. No one else has the chance to get remotely close. There's no room for anybody else or for anything else. Maybe today is the day to begin to reevaluate and make sure that we have leftover energy for what really matters, to feel compassion, to meet others' needs, to love. Sometimes it's a matter of setting aside some of the things that we've been chasing after to see these things. But other times, it's also a matter of seeing the opportunities that are right in front of us. Can I ask you a question this morning? Really difficult question. How many friends do you have? How many friends? Can you count them on two hands? Then we ask the question, well, what even is a friend? Well, the good news is that some really good researchers have done some looking into this, and they've found that there are actually four different levels of friendship. We'll put that up on the screen there. There is the meaningful relationships that we have, kind of like casual friendships. Someone you might call a friend on Facebook, a person you quite happily talk to about what you did in the weekend. But then closer than that, we have people who are friends, those we like to spend time with a little bit more often. And then closer than that, we have good friends, friends who do life with you. You would have them around for a meal or look to do something with them on the weekend. And then we have our closer friendships, our intimate friendships, those who know you deeply and you know deeply. And the research shows that most people have somewhere between one and sometimes up to nine of those intimate relationships. And so you can see that there are people in your life at all sorts of different levels. And sometimes it's not just about bringing people into that intimate place, but seeing how you can continue to relate with people at all levels. Sometimes when we talk about this sort of thing, it can feel like God wants you to bring every person into that deepest level of your life. That's not what we're talking about, though we definitely need to be ready for that hurting person to love. But it could be a good opportunity for us to consider the people you already have in your life. Think about their needs and how you might serve them. Maybe you can move them through your groups or just keep an eye towards their needs. I talked with a church member this week who told me they shared a birthday text with a former church member. They kept connected. The former church member's, her husband, then became quite ill quite recently. And his faith is unknown. And that person who was sharing birthday texts has now been asked to go and to meet with them. And there's an opportunity just by sending a birthday text to be able to be welcomed in at a time of need. Sometimes it's maintaining those connections and then seeing how we can go deeper when the moment calls. Because he stayed in touch, he has an excellent opportunity to show love and compassion, and we can do the same. I had a neighbor I was able to show the love of Jesus to for a season. He was quite sick. And I, to be honest with you, I was slow in expressing my care. I knew he was sick. I knew that this is someone that God had called me to reach out to. But I struggled to find the time. Do I go knock on his door? We didn't seem to connect that often. And eventually, my excuses ran out. And I knew I needed to step forward and do something. And my neighbor was amazing, was so receptive to genuine love, but also to the gospel, to being able, me sharing about who Jesus is and what he does in our lives. Opportunities are all around us. Are we walking by, or are we taking the time to be filled with compassion and to act? So, we've got these things that we can do. The fourth one is to lift people up. We have a pandemic of loneliness in our world at the moment, and it might feel like it's hard to know how to help. I want to act, but I don't know how. We'll talk about loving people and sharing the gospel through word, sign, and deed in the coming weeks, as I mentioned. But I just want to give you one idea today that you can put into action this week. Last week, we, in our evening service in the city, we had an amazing racial equality panel. Fantastic time. And part of that, we had Anthony Nihoniho, who was part of our congregation here, and he was talking about this wonderful concept, a Māori concept, that is so beautiful. I think it's a gospel idea. It's called manakitanga. Manakitanga. Manakitanga is about lifting up the mana of another person. Mana means someone's prestige or their status. Āki means to lift up. And tanga means a person's identity. And he said this understanding is at the core of what it means to be Māori. And this is a beautiful thing that they try and do as a people to others. And we can try and do to others as well. Build close relationships and then think, how could I lift this person up? Maybe that's something for you to go away this week. How can I pray for people? I meet someone, I pray for them. And then I think manakitanga. What can I do to lift up this person's status, to lift up who this person is in this moment? As we lay ourselves down and we seek the good of others, we don't look only to our own interests, but also to the interests of others. We're able to be moved by compassion, to count the cost. We're able to lift people up. We're able to draw near to others in relationship. I read of a three-phase experiment that was done with 100 college graduates preparing for youth ministry. In the first phase, what they did is they took a member of the group out of the room and they blindfolded them. When this person came back in, they found out that everyone had been given the instruction of yelling instructions at this person. They came back in and this room erupted with instructions that people were yelling at them. But in the midst of this, what they didn't know, and no one in the room knew, is that one person had been given the instruction to shout a very specific task, as though it was a matter of life and death. They were to attempt to persuade the blindfolded volunteer to climb the steps at the back of the auditorium and to embrace an instructor who was standing there. So everybody's yelling these instructions. You can imagine, you know, a room full of this many people, a lecture room just full of all of these voices. And the blindfolded student stood in the middle of the room and began to do one thing and then another and really just didn't move at all. He was paralyzed by confusion and indecision. He moved randomly and without purpose. He couldn't find any unmistakable voice in the crowd. They took the blindfolded volunteer back out and they began the second phase of the experiment. In the second phase, they let the room know that there was this person who had this life and death message. And they then allowed that person to stand up off their chair. Everyone had to be seated, but this person could stand up and they could speak to this person and tell them this message. At the same time, they allowed a second person to try and stop them, and they could stand up and try and stop them. So again, they bring the blindfolded volunteer in. And again, the room erupts and all of these people who are shouting these individual commands. And right beside this blindfolded volunteer are these two different voices. One telling them this life and death message about hugging this instructor at the back of the room. And then the other one trying to stop them. And this blindfolded volunteer began to move in one direction, but then became confused and moved in the other direction. And again, the result of the experiment was that the blindfolded volunteer didn't complete what they were required to they didn't complete it at all. In the third phase, they only changed one thing, just one simple thing. Everything else was the same. They told the person with the life and death message, you're allowed to touch them. You can't pull them, you can't push them, you can't coerce them, but you're allowed to touch them. So they bring the blindfolded volunteer back in. And again, the room erupts and all of this noise. And this person who's trying to stop them is right in their ear telling them what not to do. But the one person who had the life and death message gently puts their arm around them, starts to speak quietly and softly, directly into their ear. begins to lead them. Occasionally, the blindfolded volunteer stops, not sure, but of indecision, but then keeps on going again. A moment of realization comes over the room as the blindfolded volunteer heads towards the back. They realize what's going to happen. They see what's going to take place. And they begin to chant together, "Don't go, don't go, don't go." Finally, the blindfolded volunteer makes it right up to the top of the steps. With one more whispered instruction, they open their arms and they throw it around the instructor who is standing at the back. And the whole room erupts in cheers and applause. These people who are against them are now quite happy to see that they've succeeded. Isn't that true of our world? So many voices, so many people telling which way others should go. We need to be those who get close. They then asked the blindfolded volunteer, they said, "Take your blindfold off, let's have a talk about this. Why did you follow that person who put his arm around you? Why did you follow them?" The blindfolded volunteer said, "Because I felt like they were the only one who cared. The only one who cared. The only one who got close enough to actually show that they cared." That is what we're called to do, to love our neighbor, to get close enough to show that we care, to show compassion, to show love, to count the cost, to build close relationships, to bring manaakitanga, to lift others up. God got close to us through Jesus. He didn't just do it from a distance. He got involved in the mess of our lives. And we can do the same for others.
Thanks for listening to this week's message. To learn more about our church, visit c3chch.org.